Oh, welcome to today's talk. It's interesting, the names of the days even. Saturday was the first day we sat. Sunday was a very sunny day. Monday, the full moon. Tuesday, you can choose. Wednesday is, when's it going to happen? I've been meditating all this time. I'll leave it there. But anyway, last night, I was a bit tired, I must admit, so talking about five hindrances, I said I was going to talk about them this morning, but also I remembered I was going to also talk about the part two of the opening up the lotus flower. So see if I could put them all together, the lotus flower and the hindrances. Because it's all talking about the same thing, just how to understand the nature of the body and the mind, how to create calm, peace, understand happiness, understand freedom, and to open up the lotus. And you also obviously need to understand and overcome the hindrances, and also to, by understanding and overcoming those hindrances, that you open up this incredible thing called your body and mind and find out what's inside and how beautiful it is. So, the lotus simile, I was getting as far as the delightful breath. And remember, it closes up and there might be all sorts of unpleasant things on the outside, pain, depression, just frustration, whatever. And of course, if you fight those things, it just makes it worse. So, instead of fighting these things, we learn how to be still. Let go of wanting. There are two types of meditation. Who knows what those two types of meditation are? You're smart, you've listened to me before. Because I only ask a question when it's a trick question and you answer the question, they usually sort of say wrong. Because most people say samatha vipassana, and that is not what I mean. That's not the two types of meditation, they're the same meditation. What is the two types of meditation is second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation, classic Buddhist teachings. Second noble truth is craving, wanting. What's it the cause of? Suffering, yeah. So, that's the first type of meditation. You want something. You want to get the nimittas. You want to get the jhanas. You see all these people, they do this wonderful, I was sitting for 2 hours and really blissful, and just like, I had a sore bum afterwards. That was nothing compared to the bliss. And so, oh, I wonder who that was. You know, why not me? I've been coming to these retreats for such a long time, I've given lots of donations, I've been keeping the 8 precepts and 5 precepts, and I've been doing so much meditation, and these JoJos come in for the first time and they get everything that's really unfair. You can see the jealousy caused by wanting. So, if that's you, and you're suffering, why? You've been doing second noble truth meditation. You wanted something. Wanting is a cause of suffering. Should be quite obvious. So, second noble truth meditation causes you to be frustrated, disappointed, suffering. Sometimes we think the way to overcome that is put more effort in. Come on, give it everything you've got. This is an amazing opportunity. Don't waste it, okay? So, sit straight, don't move, forget about lunch, forget about interviews, we can just sit here all day. Have you ever thought like that? I did that once, years ago. Stupid layperson at a great university. There's so many stupid people in those universities, I admit that. And the first Waisak, when the Buddha became enlightened, and I heard this saying that the Buddha said, even though my blood might dry up, and my bones will turn to dust. I will not move from this seat until I get complete full enlightenment. And I was so inspired when I heard that. I was only 18. No, 19. Yeah, 18. Only 18. I only just started meditation. My PB, my personal best, was 20 minutes. So I said, right, this is it. If the Buddha could do this, why can't I do this? And I said, this is it. I went back to my room, set my cushion up, and I made that vow. Even though my blood might dry up and my bones turn to dust, I'm not going to move, no matter how painful it is. I'm tough too. And I am intelligent. And even more importantly, I've got so many other things to do in my life. I have to get this enlightenment out of the way this afternoon. So I get on to the other things. So, right, this was it. So I sat down and made a determination. I said, I'm not going to move, doesn't matter how much it hurts. And after about 20 minutes, eating getting to my usual time, I get up. No, I'm not going to get up. I started to get sore. 25 minutes, it wasn't just my bum was sore. My knees were sore, my back was sore. I'm not going to move. 30 minutes, and I was really in agony. It was just really tough. 35 minutes, I was probably sweating. And just really, just so much pain, I couldn't believe it. And 40 minutes, that was it. I couldn't stand it anymore. And I opened my eyes, and you know, I'm really disappointed. My blood hadn't dried up yet. My bones were intact, and I certainly was not enlightened. And you see, just an arrogant young man, just what they do, is so stupid, thinking, well, I can do anything. So anyway, that I learnt a lot from that. That was classic second noble truth meditation. Wanting leads to suffering. And if ever you're having a hard time in your meditation, if you have suffering of any sort in your meditation, I'm talking about the mental suffering, physical suffering, yeah, you just deal with it, but the mental, why is this not happening? Why whoever else could sit here? Have you ever been like that? You're sitting here and you open your eyes and you see some of these really smart alecs and they're just sitting there so peaceful and kind with a smile on their face and you're really suffering and that really, really upsets you. I remember doing this when I used to go on meditation retreats as a participant. I would think, okay, I am going to be the last person in a meditation room at night time. That's my resolution. So that, you know, I would meditate the longest. So I'd be sitting there and meditating. And just after the talk in the evening, meditating. And after about half an hour, I'd open my eyes. Damn it, there's still three people there. And I close my eyes, another 15, 20 minutes. Went past, and I went, she's still there. I better stay a bit longer. And in the end, she won. I left. That's crazy stuff, isn't it? Just wanting and materialism and ego and stuff like that causes a lot of suffering. Second Noble Truth Meditation, letting go. Renunciation, letting go. And then, that leads to Nibbana. Nibbanam paramang sukhang, the highest happiness. It was just there, were the first teachings of the Buddha, and he kept on missing it. Let go leads to freedom, Nibbana. Craving leads to suffering. I even said that the first talk. Remember that simile? Ajahn Chah's, the hand only weighs, moves because of the wind. You want something. If you stop wanting, it becomes still all by itself. So what do people do? They want it to be still. Come on, be still. I haven't got all day. Well, actually, I've got a few more days left, but you know, time is clicking by. So please, come on, quick. I've only got 3 or 4 days left. And anyway, you want to get sort of still first of all, because after you get still, you've got all the psychic powers that develop and enlightenment. And all, you've got lots of things to do, yeah, you know, just you've got to get still at first. Come on, otherwise you won't have any time to get any psychic powers. So instead, people say, whenever you want something, you're disturbing the mind. It moves again. You're losing the path. So, remember those two types of meditation. Second noble truth, wanting causes suffering. So if you're suffering, you're disappointed, frustrated, even angry, you wanted something, find that out, what it was. If you're letting go, or if you're having a wonderful meditation, it means you've let go of something. Well done. Learn from that. Because the basic part of the first hindrance is wanting. Kamachanda. Mostly just wanting things relating to the five sense world. But because people don't really know much about the mind world, think they do, but they don't. Because of that, that's why that most of the wanting concerns stuff and things. And, you know, just our control of things and what people think of us and fears of the past and fears of the future. The past and the future is in this world. So it's really strange that people don't see that all that wanting is the first hindrance. Well, that's number one. So imagine you don't want anything in the whole world. First hindrance is gone. Totally content. So, you can test if you're totally content. If you found a bottle, oh, there's a bottle here, and you rubbed it, and a genie came out, yay, and asked me, Achampara, what do you want? Nothing. Eh? So I give you three wishes. Ah, nick off. Then you understand real happiness is being content with what you've got. So, if you've got something, what would you do with it anyway? It just gives you more business to do, more problems to do. That's why they have. I haven't had this corroborated, but somebody told me once, the two worst curses in the Arab world. Number two, this is not which won the gold prize. Number two, if you want to curse someone in the Arab world, was, this is translated, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. I don't know my nature. I thought that was at least inventive. As you saw, fleas getting in your armpits. Ooh. That's how you would curse somebody. So don't try that. If you do try it, please don't admit it came from me. It would totally ruin my reputation if it's not ruined already. But the worst one was the interesting one. And for them it was, may all your wishes be granted immediately. And that was a curse. Whoever actually invented that, they had some insight. If you want something, it may be given to you straight away. No struggle. Imagine what that would be like. You thought of it and it came straight away. You would just encourage this incessant wishing and wanting and not realizing there's an escape which is much better than wanting, called the freedom. Of this freedom, that's right, the two freedoms, the freedom of desire, so you get whatever you want whenever you want it. That's one type of freedom. But the superior freedom is called the freedom from desire. Desire is like an itch, it's like a fever, it's like a wanting which always disturbs you. So you get what you want immediately, and then that just encourages more desire. No end to it. But when you're freedom from desire, there is the end. So feel it for wanting. So that is one of the reasons why in opening the lotus, it's not about wanting. It's being aware and being kind. Kindness, compassion, metta, is the opposite of wanting. That's why when sometimes people, Venerable Posada knows this, sometimes that they say, "Oh, Achyuthananda, you're going overseas. Have a nice flight." I say, "No, I am not going to follow your orders. Why should I do what you tell me? I'm the senior monk. You're the disciple. I'm just on purpose. I'm not going to have a good flight, just to show my independence." May all beings be happy and well. Is that possible? How many times can you be happy and well? And for how long? Is that real kindness? How many times have you gone to a hospital bed and someone you love there and say, "I hope you get well soon"? That's putting the pressure on them to get well. So instead, Ajahn Chah's advice was far wiser. He didn't say to me, "I hope you get well." It was just, "You're either going to get better or you're going to die." And that was it. Didn't put any pressure on me. And sometimes what happens, and if you've ever been sick in hospital, have you ever felt really, really guilty letting people down by being sick, so they have to come and visit you, take time off, and all this stuff, and they say, "Oh, please get well soon." And then, you know, you're still at hospital, they have to come and see you, and they have to sort of, you know, you're taking up the human resources, and you get very depressed, you feel so wrong, that I should be working, I should be doing something, and you guys are always looking after me, rah, 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 rah. And you always come, "How do you feel today?" What do people say? "I feel a little bit better." When they're lying through their teeth, they're not better. They say that because out of social convention, to cheer up people who spent so much time and effort coming to see them. But I have to be careful. I know this is a surag, the Thai tradition. In the Thai tradition, a monk would only go and see a disciple who was sick in hospital only if they were next to death. You know, it was just the convention there that, you know, if you were just sick, then they wouldn't come and see you. But when you were next to death, they would always come. Which is one of the reasons why that I would go in the first years and go and see a Thai person in hospital, and they just had, just a little operation, nothing serious. And that when I came to see them, they were terrified. He said, "What's the doctor not told me? I thought I was okay." It's a totally different cultural convention. But anyway, so real kindness and compassion is not wanting anything from the other person. Not putting demands on them. You get better, and I'll still love you. You die, and I'll still love you. I give you the freedom just to be. Not demanding anything from them. I thought that was really cool when you understood that real compassion is opening the door of your heart to the other person and to yourself. Not demanding anything from them at all. May you be whatever, happy, whatever, or unhappy, the door of my heart's open to you, unconditionally. Now if you say something like that, that's almost adding loving kindness to your meditation. Mind, the door of my heart is open to you, no matter if you fall fast asleep and start snoring when you're supposed to be giving a Dhamma talk. The door of my heart's open to you. The door of my heart is open to you. Even if, I don't know, what sort of crazy thing can we do? Stop thinking about that, you naughty monk. No, okay. The door of my heart's open to you no matter what. Can you actually do that? That is loving kindness, which doesn't demand, which doesn't want anything. My experience once with this great monk, Ajahn Tate. He was the monk who, and I heard he was really a very, very great monk. He was one of the early disciples of Ajahn Mun. And when I first got to Thailand, he was the one who had very bad cancer. Don't know exactly what type of cancer, but the doctors in Bangkok gave up on him. You're going to die soon. And even though the best treatments, and she said, well, I'm going to die, I might as well die in my monastery. And no, die in Bangkok. It's not where I belong. So he went off to his monastery to die. And it was about 25 years until he actually did it, dying. So he's a really great monk. I really appreciate him. Just really, he's tiny in stature, but huge heart and presence. So I had to wait to actually be able to see him, go in queue. I know what it's like doing the interviews. You wait there, and when's that person going to be finished? And then eventually I got in there. And I had all these questions. This was a very rare opportunity to ask my questions of a very, very great monk. And when I got into his presence, you know what happened? Mind became so still, so peaceful. I didn't have any questions. All those questions, they totally evaporated on this beautiful kindness from this monk. And it was actually, that was the origin of that story I said last night or yesterday about the spikes coming out from you. This monk had absolutely no spikes at all. He felt so loved, respected, valued, no fear. Even though that, you know, had some great stupidities, still, he would never criticize me. He would never harm me, hurt me, put me down. It was, you know, totally opened the door of his heart to the stupid Western monk. And that was all the answers I needed. Just to be loved, to be accepted, to be at peace with yourself. As he was showing that to me. And I remember also at the time just thinking, this is where I'm sitting right now, this is where I'm going to die. They're going to have to drag me out of this hall, out of the presence of this monk, with chains and water buffaloes. They didn't have tractors in those days. So I'm not moving, I'm staying here, because this was really cool, just being with this brilliant, beautiful feeling of total acceptance, which gave me this incredible peace. And I remember recording that when I was reading this little book about dying to live by that Anita Murajani. I think I've eventually got the name right after many tries. That who just had out-of-body experience and went up to, basically it was this beautiful place of bliss and happiness, which she called pure love, acceptance. There's nothing wrong with her. And always the judgmental mind of trying to please other people, trying to please yourself, that was what was causing her cancer. So there's something about that which I really recognized of what happens in deep meditation and what insight is all about. Just no wanting. You're perfect. Why are you trying to improve yourself? There's a certain sense of ill will when you want to improve yourself. You're not happy with who you are. You're not happy with your state of meditation. I've got brilliant nimittas, but I haven't got into jhanas yet. So, you know, it's a negativity to where you are, wanting to get a bit deeper. I don't have negativity. I look in the mirror. I'm not fat. I looked it up in the dictionary, you know, sort of Alzheimer's. The definition of Alzheimer's disease in a dictionary, you look in a mirror and you think you're fat. I said, that's me. Alzheimer's too. Alzheimer's means you forget, it's anorexia. You see, it was Alzheimer's after all. I was thinking that one at the last moment, thank goodness. So anyway, yeah, so anorexia. Anorexia is you look in the mirror and you think you're fat. So, yep, I qualify. I remember this guy with a t-shirt, really fat, and the t-shirt, the slogan, I love these t-shirt slogans, sometimes they're very neat. I beat anorexia. So especially in meditation, like contentment, no wanting, being happy in your own skin, being happy in your own mind, being at peace with your craziness and your defilements, then they're not defilements anymore. There's something different. So those hindrances, wanting and ill will, what really are they? What do you really want? Sometimes you ask that, and if you get it, then what? You know, like as young monks, you know, young nuns, lay men, lay women, you know, we always have these fantasies. So sometimes when I was a young monk and had fantasies, you know, just, well, you know, I was still young enough. Maybe, you know, my old girlfriends were still available. Maybe, you know, if they were, I started thinking. And then I said, then what? Then what? Then what? Then what? Then what? And that is, it's like putting the fantasy on fast forward. When you got to the end, so what? I had this fantasy once of marrying the most beautiful girl in the world. And then I thought, but the most beautiful girl in the world, you know, she has to never argue with me. She has to have no ill will. It's just like male fantasies, okay? No ill will at all. Always be there for me. Have no personal desires. Never get angry. She'd have to be an arahat, fully enlightened. And then I remembered, uh-oh, arahats don't have any sensual desire. So I might as well marry a robot. You can't have desire without the ill will. It comes with the package. As anyone who's been married, had relationships for long enough knows, it's not about guys or girls, it's just the human mind. So anyway, yeah, you can sacrifice so much, but sometimes there's a limit, so in the end you just let go totally. If you really want to have some peace and contentment. And sometimes people say, oh no, 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 my relationship's different. I say, is it? Yeah, I love my wife unconditionally. I love my husband, just, I love him forever. My door of my heart's open to my husband no matter what he does. Really? Suppose when you go home, you found out that your wife has run away with your best friend. How would you feel? If you really loved them and their happiness was the most important thing in the world to you, you'd be delighted, so overjoyed that my wife is having a wonderful time with my best friend. Much better sex than I have with me. Oh, I'm so delighted. My wife is happy. When you take it to extremes like that, you notice how sometimes the human mind fantasizes and it's not real. So anyway, so letting go of desire and craving, letting go of ill will. Then what happens? Then you start opening up the door, opening up the lotus as well. Mindfulness and kindness. Real kindness. The door of my heart's open to you, and the lotus opens back in return. The simile of Kingsbury Drive. You've all come up this road to get here. I don't know if you're paying attention up the valley, but years I was always going up and down in the car. And once I told the driver that I'm going to walk today. It's one of these beautiful days, not too hot, not too cold, no flies around. And there's plenty of time, take my time just to walk up. And as I started walking up, I've been living up here for about 7 years, and this was the first time I'd walked from the bottom of the hill right to the top, along Kingsbury Drive, and it was a mind-blowing experience. because I could not recognize my surroundings. It was totally different than I'd ever remembered through looking through the window of a car. I could see so much more, smell more, and even what I saw with my eyes, it looked so much more attractive and delightful. And it was so stunning to me that I stopped and stared, and then it changed again. And what I saw was incredibly delightful and beautiful. The grass, there's so many different colors of green on each blade of grass, and it was like really brilliant in the sunlight. It was like almost getting fluorescent. And just there was the little creek, the Carnet Brook in the valley, you could see it just, falling over the rocks and the lichen on the rocks and little wildflowers, you could see them there, and the whole thing was so delightful. I thought, how come I've never seen this before? How come it's so different than I ever remember? And 7 years I've been at that time living at Bodhinyana. So once you got data, then to investigate, and of course I use my science. What is sight anyway? The light goes through the pupil of the eye, hits the retina, has a chemical reaction. The chemical reaction. I remember the time at science class developing your own photographs. In the days you had to take the photographic film and put it in the developer solution. And that was a wonderful simile, because you put this paper in the developer solution and you actually see the image slowly appear. It was not instantaneous. It took a couple of minutes for actually the shape, the colors to come out from the paper. It was a chemical reaction. And that's exactly what happens in the retina of the eye. It's a chemical reaction. So imagine the light hits the back of the eye, and before the chemical reaction has been completed, another image hits the eye, and another image hits the eye, and another image hits the eye. So no image is properly developed. So number one, you don't see the full picture. It's just, the most important parts of it you maybe see. And the colors are washed out, they're pastel. But if you spend more time, the image starts to emerge, and the colors are richer. And if you give it all the time it needs, perfectly still, just watching, even just this one sense, the eye, the picture fully forms on the back without moving to something else. And what you see is full of detail. And the colors are brighter and clearer than you've ever seen before. Nothing magical or supernatural, just nature. That is one of the reasons why restlessness is a hindrance. You haven't got time to see anything, nothing fully forms. And I really thought I knew that hillside. 7 years looking through the window is the illusion of wisdom. You have to be slow and stop for wisdom to emerge from those washed out images with only just a fraction of what's really out there. So this is the hindrance of restlessness. As you open up that lotus more and more, it becomes more and more beautiful. That was a strange thing, because I always thought the Buddhism was about suffering. But as you become more and more peaceful, more and more still, you just become more and more happy. This is nature. It's not what you sort of pretend to be. You can't stop it. That's one of the reasons, knowing that, if ever I see sort of a teacher who's miserable, who's negative, I say, I don't trust their wisdom at all. Their meditation needs to be strengthened. So he gets sign of insight, is a smile on a person's face. That tells me that they're getting some of their meditation. Because sometimes people come to interviews and say, oh, I've just had a jhana. I had second jhana today. I don't believe a word they say. I look for their... I don't disbelieve it either. I look for their facial expression, number one. I shouldn't be telling you all my tricks, because now you're practicing the mirror beforehand. I've got to look happy, so I should bunk. But sometimes you're just so blissed out. Oh, this is so nice. Oh, that was amazing meditation I had, Ajahn Brahm. Oh, so that life was so wonderful. Oh, so, okay, yep, that's one box ticked. Because it's a huge, happy experience. So anyway, that when you go slow, you feel more. So when restlessness disappears, your mind is not going places. It's going nowhere. Remember what nowhere means? Going nowhere? Now and here. That was nowhere, it's a compound. Now and here. So when you're now and here, you're going nowhere. You're being nowhere. How wonderful that is. You're being a nobody. Because it's just the mind and the body is vanishing. Being nobody, being nowhere. Isn't that wonderful? And then, restlessness overcome, and the sign of restlessness overcome, you see more. You've got more time just to be. And just, what happens is just like that hillside, just like the lotus, it opens up for you. There's a little thing when I say, may think it's a bit of a joke or an excuse, to go and have a cup of tea outside the kitchen or the dining room and just watch the trees grow. Is it one of Ajahn Brahm's stupid jokes? No. Sit there and watch the trees open out for you. See so much more beauty in there. You're sitting there being still, not expecting anything, not doing anything. Just being there watching. The trees become really green and beautiful. Why haven't you seen that before? Restlessness. Not always doing things. Always trying to get something, going somewhere, attaining things, trying to have something to put in your CV that I've had first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, trying to sort of tick off things in your bucket list. Yeah, jhana's done, enlightenment done, now what's next in my bucket list before I die? All this wanting and attainment stuff. So, if you just sit there, not wanting anything in the whole world, the mind is not restless. It stops. It's still. And because what you see is really enjoyable, you can't, not faking it, simple things, like just seeing a bird flying through the air. It flies through the air every day. When you're really still and you've got the time and no one's pressuring you to try and get somewhere, do something, produce something or complete something, you can actually enjoy them flying through the air. So wonderful experiences with even little birds over in Thailand. And this way, just going, lovely anecdotes. There was, you know, when you're a monk in Thailand and you just really are living in nature, that hot season in Thailand, I put a little bowl in a kannam of water out for the birds in the afternoon, because it's really hot and it's a long way to the nearest water source. So I just put it outside my hut for them to bathe in and to drink. And you've seen that before. The birds go in the water and they flap their wings, and you can see they're really having a good time. They get themselves nice and soaked, they drink a little bit, and then they fly off. Really cute. But this one, I put it outside. I don't know, sometimes the birds will be scared of human beings, big fellows. So I would watch them through a knot hole in the wooden plank of my hut. So sometimes in the afternoon I looked through the little knot hole, so I could see them and they couldn't see me. It's like a spy hole. And I couldn't believe what I saw. Remember, this is Thailand, Asia, not Singapore. If it was Singapore birds, I would, okay, maybe. All the birds formed a queue. They were in line. All different species and sizes. Little ones, big ones. And they all were waiting patiently until the one in front jumped inside the bowl, washed themselves, drank a little bit, and when they were finished, they flew off, and the next one in the queue sort of went in. I've never seen this amongst human beings in Bangkok, never. But over there, there's birds. No one taught them, they just did it. But the funny thing was, of course, that every now and again, you'd wait for it, it would happen soon. One of the birds would come up and would jump the queue and try and get in the bowl of water first. And the other birds, they would all get out of their queue and they'd peck and beat this other bird out, this queue's up, and the other bird would fly away. And then the other birds would reform the queue exactly where they were before. Oh, that was amazing to see that. Does that happen at the buffet tables when you have your lunch? So anyway, except for the beating up, you all keep the queue. But anyway, so those things happen, but sometimes we're far too busy to actually notice things. If we can just stop and be still, stop all our restlessness, be in this moment, be content. It's amazing what this moment teaches you. There's so much beauty and harmony and peace when we're not running around. You had a great time to do that here. And even the ordinary stuff, you see the, it's like, because it's right in front of me, the beautiful bamboo. So many different colors of brown and golds and oranges and yellows. Sometimes when your mind is open and peaceful, not restless, you can spend all of my talk just looking at the bamboo. I don't know, maybe some of you are. But it's, things become delightful. That's what happens when restlessness disappears. When it's delightful, there's lots of torpor left. Because your meditation is interesting, it's fascinating, it is delightful. That's why in that meditation when the lotus opens up to the delightful breath. What's so delightful about the breath? Breathing in, breathing out. And people will tell me, you spent all those hours watching your breath. Weren't you bored? Actually, no. It was amazing. It was delightful. So you are crazy, Ajahn Brahm. Well, if everybody thought I was wise, I would never get any rest at all. So actually, I cultivate that some people think I'm crazy and mad because that means I can get a rest at night time. Sometimes there's many advantages of not being popular. Sometimes I'd really get overworked, that's why I was a bit tired yesterday, and sometimes people are always asking questions, thinking I'm wise, and sometimes I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if I said some really stupid things, and then people wouldn't sort of come and ask me any questions anymore, or even better, tell these old jokes again and again and again. That was my number one strategy, always telling bad jokes and repeating them time and time and time again over, until people got bored of them. And then I could really be a hermit again, and just stay in my cave and just relax all day. I thought, but it didn't work that way. None of my plans ever work out. They always have unintended consequences. So anyway, when you are content, you're happy. You're not sort of no sloth and torpor anymore. Depression, negativity, vanished. And everything is delightful. So you look at all the human beings in this room, you're delighted. You look at the trees in the forest. Here comes my tree in the forest in me, which is a really great one, but said it many, many times. When you walk in the forest, find the most beautiful tree, the one you're attracted to, the one, if you were going to have a photograph taken, you'd have your photograph taken by that tree. What does it look like? You'll find the tree which attracts you the most, which is the most beautiful, is the one which is all twisted. Twisted and damaged and broken and bent. Those are my favourite trees. Going this way and that way, and just all the branches where they're torn off, the holes where the animals can stay. They're gorgeous. If you saw one which is really straight, all the branches in the right place, and no damage on the trunk at all. That must be plastic. Must be so, you know, just been planted there as an ornament or something, but it's not real. So I mentioned that the most beautiful things in the world are the damaged ones. So if you really want to be beautiful, and you're looking for a partner in life, don't go to beauty parlor. Go to ugly parlor. Get a bit twisted and damaged. You become lovable. So the idea there, you don't have to get somewhere to be delightful. You don't have to change things to be delightful. You understand and care for things, and then they become beautiful and delightful. That's why the breath, going in, going out, is delightful. And it actually feels like that. You're watching, wow, this breath is so wonderful. People have been doing walking meditation. Just walking backwards and forwards. Now that's like sentries do outside Buckingham Palace. Is that part of meditation? But after a while, it becomes, you're really enjoying this. Just watching the feet move. Nothing much to do. It's not to do with the feelings in the feet becomes delightful. It's because your mind is peaceful. And it can actually see the beauty. Like in the Valley of Kingsbury Drive, the beauty in your feet, the beauty in the bamboo floor, the beauty in the breath. In Pali it's called Akaya Sankara. Chitta Sankara. That's how the mind sees the breath when it's peaceful. Delightful. Gorgeous. And there you really can just watch this breath for a long time. And I say, the hindrances are starting to really disappear. And the last of those hindrances is doubt. Which path should you follow? Vipassana, Samatha, Ajahn Brahm's easy way, or Goenka's tough way? Should you be, what should you, Mahayana, Theravada, sort of Hinayana? I like the small vehicle, that's why I've got the smallest teddy. Hinayana, the small vehicle. it's just a smaller teddy in this, smaller teddy bear in the joint? Don't think so. I know that somebody who comes on retreats regularly said, oh, look at these teddy bears, they've been having babies. But anyhow, so things become delightful and beautiful. And when you become delightful and beautiful, that's only the start. You are content, kind, aware, and the awareness is no force at all. Anything which is beautiful, which is delightful, draws the mind onto it. It draws your attention. It's just automatic. So this breath is delightful. You can't take your eyes off it. Until no restlessness, and you get very, very peaceful. And this is your own direct experience. It's actually quite surprising. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm says these things, but you don't really believe me. Or maybe, until you experience it for yourself, and wow, this is actually happening. Little things like, you know, the outside of the lotus is really rough. And you think, yeah, well, maybe all these people who've been meditating for a long time, maybe they can get into these jhanas, and then it happens to you. Ooh, that's a bit much. You know, oh yeah, great experience, but me? We always have doubt about ourselves. Doubt that we're not good enough. and somehow or other I trick you. Just stage by stage, being content, being peaceful, sitting down here, and these things happen. I think, wow, I always thought I was this rough old lotus and nothing useful was inside. But then you open up and you find out in you how incredible, beautiful those petals are inside. Even the delightful parts of the mind, nimittas and the jhanas. And it's as if, you know, like at universities, schools and universities, when you pass one exam, then it's like you're qualified to go deeper. When you have passed one exam of letting go and kindness, then a more interesting exam, not tougher, but more refined exam. You have to let go a lot to start you to come here. You pass that exam, you're at a meditation retreat. Oh yeah, great. Now to sit here, now you have to let go a lot just to be able to sit with your eyes closed for half an hour or an hour or whatever. And once you can do that, you get another little test. You let go of your past and future. Yes, I haven't done that before, but little by little, yeah, you can do that. It gets more and more pleasant the deeper you go. You let go of your thinking. Isn't that gorgeous? You're silent. You pass out, wow, I can do that. There's some people that, you know, do that little trick of, you know, just gaps between words, and they can do that. I remember teaching these, only half an hour, I think, lunchtime meditation for executives in Kong Men Sun in Singapore. And didn't have much time, so I did that gap between the words. Never explained what I was doing, just did it. And all these people, and they actually got it. It was silent, and how beautiful that was. They could do it. That was the main thing, that they, busy in their lives, could be silent. Not for long, but at least in long enough to say, yeah, it's possible, and they could experience what it was like. So, you can do it. That doubt in your own abilities. Also, there's a doubt in the teacher and the teachings. That's a hard, oh, actually, they're all pretty hard. But the doubt in the teachings, hopefully you realize that if enlightenment is the highest bliss, the closer you get, it should be more and more delightful. And I always say that that's a much easier gauge of a person's progress, if you like. Not their wisdom, because many people, they confuse wisdom with knowledge. In other words, they can write huge books about Buddhism, and they end up hitting other people over the head with their books. Oops. How many books have I read? Have I wrote? Written. So anyway, yeah, sometimes you've got to write a few books, but that's not the point. The point is that wisdom, really knowing, is something which creates peace and happiness, which lets go of things, which doesn't hold on to things from the past. You can let them go. When you let them go, you're free. Why on earth do people, simple simile, but it makes a strong point. Someone calls me stupid. Ajahn Brahm, you're stupid. Now, suppose I reacted. Who are you to call me stupid? That's disrespectful. You shouldn't call a monk stupid. You don't know all the hard work I've done and calling me stupid like that. That is wrong. That is mean. That is nasty, calling me stupid. That is bad speech, calling me stupid. And then I stop and remember, oh my goodness, he's just called me stupid 5 more times. Every time I think about it, they're calling me stupid again. It's obvious they were right. I am stupid. They've hurt you, cheated you. They cheated me. Why did they cheat me? They shouldn't cheat me. Every time you remember it, they're cheating you again. Why do you do that? Please, only be able to be hurt once. They call you stupid. Everyone's allowed their opinion. Free speech. Doesn't mean it's right. And there you go. They call me, oh, just a wonderful, kind monk. Well, remember that. They call me a kind monk. Yes, I'm going to keep that. Why not? Give it a try. It makes you much happier. Both of them are just really stupid and wrong. But nevertheless, given the choice. So, so anyway, this is where you get the wisdom from. And a wisdom is something which frees you from suffering. That's how you know it's not what doubt is. See if it frees you from suffering, if it makes you peaceful, if it makes you happy. And if you doubt your own judgment, ask the people you live with, the people you work with. And if you go back from this meditation retreat and the people you live with and have to put up with you think you're even worse as a human being after you come back from the retreat, then never come back here again. It's not working for you. But if afterwards they say, oh, you're such a kinder mummy. Oh, as a daddy, it's wonderful when you come back from the retreat. As a worker, like this one exec did when she came here, she said she had to beg and grovel from her boss to get time off to come on a retreat. But she sent me this amazing email. And when she went back to work on a Monday after this retreat, the boss took one look at her and said, what drug have they been giving you in Perth? I don't mind what it is, but next time you bring me back some. Straight away could see that she was so peaceful and happy. That is how you overcome doubt. It's working. And you're not deceiving yourself, because other people can see it. Da da da. So, that's 9 o'clock, and I promised myself I would keep to the clock today. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. One little announcement before we go off to the interviews is, if I remember correctly, Ajahn Bhumari was telling me that they're delivering 4 water tanks up to next, where the other water tanks are, the big concrete ones, is 4 plastic ones coming up there, potty ones. So be careful if you go for a walk up there. Otherwise, you'll be squashed meditator. There must be some big trucks and people working out there, so try and avoid that area. Down the bottom there, it's fine. But I'm not quite sure what time they're coming, do you know? So here, a truck up there, and monks messing around, you know what they're doing. They're tanking out. Okay, have a nice morning. You don't have to. Totally up to you. If you want to be grumpy, the door of my heart's open to you, even if you're miserable.